This is CliffCentral.com.
It is hard to believe it's been 25 years since she was crowned Miss South Africa, 25 years since making her TV debut, and 25 years into our democracy. Basitsana Khumalo is here. She's released her memoir, which is called Basi, My Journey of Hope. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Gareth. And it's so good to see you after a while.
Awesome to
see
you.
You're looking good.
Well, you walked in here like a vision. You just look spectacular.
Thank you.
But you really are such an inspiration, because we have, you know, we have a country that's changed so much over 25 years. We have so much that's gone on that people tend to forget. We have to remind ourselves of what a great story this is. And in some ways, for me, you've always symbolized that story, because you are the person that many of us think of as being someone who broke through at a time when there wasn't, you know, besides the politics, there wasn't a lot for people to find inspiration in. And you gave us a moment to be inspired and to take stock and to look at ourselves and go, wow, there is beauty, there is happiness, there is joy.
There is hope.
And there's abundance, you know.
Indeed, indeed.
To make things happen. So how are you doing?
I'm pretty good, hey. I'm really awesome. It's been a whirlwind of a time since the launch of my memoir. I'm just still so overwhelmed by how it's been warmly received.
Well, it's number one.
By the best, greater public.
Best non-fiction book in the country, right?
It is. It is. As of the 1st of November, we got the news that it's the best-selling non-fiction book in South Africa and the number two bestseller of all books in South Africa. So it's really humbling that you could get to pen and paper and write your own true story. And little did I know that so many people will find inspiration in that truth and in that journey. And you're right. I mean, we come from a country where we are an inspired nation.
Mm.
We are a country.
We forget that, though.
We forget that we are a formidable force.
Yeah.
We are an energized people and a people of hope. And so what has happened, of course, in the last 25 years has brought much distress to many South Africans. We're not where we should be in terms of, you know, you look at the rate of high unemployment, the rate of femicide, you know, xenophobia. And so we need to really revisit that which we are as a people and ignite that sense of optimism, that sense of hope, and that sense of wanting this country to be better, because we can only get it better if collectively we work together. And so fast forward 25 years later, we're here, and I still have that sense of optimism and hope and belief that this country is going to do better and get things right as we traverse into the next 25 years of our democracy.
Just tell me, is it true that you kept a journal and you used to write stuff down almost every day so that writing this book, you had notes that you could rely on?
I've journaled for the better part of my adult life, Gareth. I have multiple journals. I mean, 30, 40 journals.
That's a discipline, right?
It's a discipline that I, you know, cultivated at a very young age. When I was about 19, I really earnestly started to journal. And when I won Miss South Africa at the age of 20, I was very cognizant of what that moment in time represented. New democracy, new government, new leadership, a new dispensation, a new hope, a rainbow nation of Matiba, and then to win at that time. So for me, I speak about the Zeitgeist of my winning together with where South Africa was, 1994, and I could have not scripted it any better, even if I tried to script.
There was a crowning, in so many ways, the crowning achievement of what many people would say was a lifetime, but also scary, because if that happens to you at the start of your story, a lot of people expect that it's going to have to get better and better, but it could also, that could be the highlight for some people, and then after that, their life starts to go nowhere.
And it becomes a denouement.
Yeah.
What was very clear for me, though, I realized that the reign is only but 12 months. What was critical was what I was going to do with my life post the reign. And I literally journaled what my short-term goals would be in that year, mm-hmm. which will just be the 12 months, what my medium-term goals would be, and what my long-term goals would be. As a 20-year-old, I mean, thrust into this limelight, And it was very daunting, but I was cognizant that every moment that I was experiencing, I had to chronicle it. I had to live it fully so that I could come to this side and be able to write about it. And so that's why the journaling was very, very important for me.
But when you journal, you were also writing what you wanted from your life and what you expected in a year, 2 years, 3 years from then. And for a lot of people, that seems almost like wish thinking, but you know that the powerful thing about that is that you tend to have your dreams come to reality.
It holds you accountable.
When you plan them.
When you journal and you put your thoughts to paper, it literally holds you accountable and responsible to be able to make that of which you've written down to come to fruition and to come to pass. And I'm a believer. And there's a scripture in the book of Habakkuk that speaks about making your petitions known on tablet form. Back in the days, they used to write on tablet form. And so I was very clear. So my short-term goal was as basic as getting a driver's license. I'd won a car as Miss South Africa, and I'd have a driver's license.
Right.
my medium-term goal, I wanted to travel, Gareth. I wanted to see the world. The furthest I had traveled outside of Soweto was to Durban on my father's bucky, going to Mgababa Beach, the first time I saw the ocean, the expanse of the ocean. So my medium-term goal, I wanted to travel. And little did I know that putting it out there to the universe, it was going to really be part of my life, and henceforth meeting patients and, you know, presenting top billing and starting to travel internationally. I managed to be able to make that dream a reality. And then, of course, my long-term goal was I always just wanted to be self-employed. I've never been employed since I was a 20-year-old. I've always been self-employed. I wanted to write my own check.
And you started off like selling lollipops and things at age what?
Six.
Yeah, unbelievable. So you see this entrepreneurial, what would you call it, flair was in you right from the start.
I started working with money from an early age, at the age of six, to be precise. And Robert Kiyosaki, in his book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, he advocates that we need to teach our children to work with money from an early age. So little did I know that when I went to go and sell my tray of eggs up and down the street, and we'd come back home with my siblings and we had to add up the pennies, that was a formal training in my mother's kitchen.
All of you have ended up being really smart in that same way, because I think your parents must have engendered that in you at an early age.
My parents were very savvy in teaching us how to work with money, how to save, what to invest in. And I remember distinctly my mother, may her soul rest in peace. She often used to say, if you made a little money in life, always invest it in property. Don't buy fancy cars. So I've always grew up with that inculcation in my mind that if I made a little bit of profit, I must buy property. And my siblings and I have taken her teaching to heart to this day forth.
Just tell me, in the way that you put this book together, you had these journals to rely on. Do you ever let anyone else see your journals?
No.
Or is this something that's just for you, right?
When you're writing your deepest, most inner thoughts, you write them because you bear your soul into those pages. But when I had made the decision to write my memoir, or maybe perhaps I should say to finish my memoir, because it's been a work in progress.
It's a work in progress.
Over the years. Mm. And when I made the decision to finish my memoir, I was only going to write an honest, candid, raw account of my life. And not sugarcoat anything, not sanitize anything. And I'm very vulnerable in the book, in how I speak my truth. I had to go to places that I'd hope I had buried, but I realized that I had not even had begun to deal with those dark chapters of my life and parts of my life and experiences of my life. And so the book really forced me to go there, to process the pain, the hurt, the anger, the abuse, the depression. And the book then forced me to find my place of healing. It's been so cathartic, the writing process, and it's equally been so healing. Now I sit here, I feel unburdened no more. I feel empowered because I've owned my voice back. I've told my story in my own voice. You know, Gareth, as a public figure, oftentimes people, you know, they write good articles about you or not so good articles about you.
But you're not the author.
But I'm not the author. But also over the years, I've learned not to take people's perception of me to define and determine who I am and what I become. But even if it's a good article, I've also learned through the years, I don't believe my own media, my own hype. I don't drink my own Kool-Aid.
Right.
So I had to take the time to really take my voice back. And it is important to tell our stories. And I wanted to tell my story in the most candid way that, you know, a child from the hood, Ekas, could be able to dream. And dream big dreams, and those dreams have impacted so many lives because she just dared. She was not afraid to fail. She was bold enough to want to challenge the status quo of what women can achieve, what a black girl child can achieve, and how she is paying it forward and bringing others along. So the memoir for me was really to just open a whole universe of who Bastana is, what she believes in.
Did you write it for someone in particular in your head? Like, while you were imagining telling this story, did you think, you know, one of the kids maybe? Or
I have written the book for my kids.
Yeah.
I dedicate the book for my kids. And you know why? Because I wanted my kids and their children and their children's children to one day, if they ever had to wonder, who was grandma? Who was great grandma? What did she believe in? What brought her hope? What brought her pain? How did she survive? How did she build this empire?
And in her own words, because this is also what's so special, right? We live in a continent where we have an oral tradition and where people pass down the stories of our ancestors. And sometimes stuff gets lost in translation. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes we forget bits and pieces of it. You know, the old granny who you remember telling you a story when you were younger, you can't remember exactly what she said to you. And stuff gets lost.
Stuff gets lost, but also then stuff gets misrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
They say that lies told into history live as truth. And if that lie continues to be perpetuated, it will stand. And so there's a lot of untruths that also have been said about me and my family over the years. And I said, I cannot let my children, who today when they Google, they pick up an untruth, a diabolical lie about their parents and let it slide. And that's why even the dedication I say here to my hashtag heartbeat, Nkosinati Gabriel, Ushaga Khosizile Emmanuel, and Bontleba Morena Jasmine, I wrote this book for you to know my truth, to hear my story in my own voice. I love you to infinity.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. You wish your mom had seen the book?
I wish she would have seen the book. And my dad.
They got to see you live an amazing life. They got to see much of your success.
My dad never got to meet any of my children. Papa passed on in 2003, and then Nati was born in 2005. My mom was the only one who met Nati, and then she passed on when he was 18 months old. If you ask me, what are the things that sometimes make you sad, Basi? It's really that my parents never met the tribe. It is the fact that they would have doted over these kids. But I have to say that I see a lot of my mom in my daughter, Bontle. She's feisty. She literally runs the show. We live in her house. She tells us jump, we say how high, ma'am. She's resolute, she's brave, she's courageous. So she has, you know, a lot of my mother's traits. And she's very forthright and unafraid. And so she's my teacher.
Hmm.
And I'm always open to the lessons that all my children teach me every day. And but I think my parents would be proud, and I believe that they still live on, their spirit, and you know, still lives with us. And it is also in honor of their legacy of the woman that they raised that I wanted to write this book. My mother was a teacher, my father was a bus driver, and to give a sense that it is possible for anybody, it does not matter where you come from.
Mm-hmm.
You have to work hard in life. You know, I get very disturbed when I get with this new generation that have a sense of entitlement. Nobody owes you anything in life.
Right.
And so for me, I wanted to ignite a new conversation about entrepreneurship, a new conversation about how a country can go forward, a new conversation about authentic and selfless leadership with the Madibas, for example, who I journeyed with quite intensely in the book. I wanted to ignite a conversation about women empowerment. I wanted to ignite conversation about, you know, I've had 7 miscarriages that life happens to the best of us.
But I want to reflect on something before we go into the book, because there's some stories there I do want to pick up on. You said now you get annoyed when you hear people who feel perhaps entitled or that imagine that your journey was easy and that they know everything about you from what they've read in the newspapers. Optimism also is in rare supply at the moment. You know, it's in short supply. There are not a lot of people who bounce around with optimism. And I mean, we remember 1994, there was a lot of real concern and pain, and people weren't sure that it would all work out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you remember there was this lack of security on all sides, and it was due to good leadership, and it was due to people who decided, hell no, we're going to make something out of this.
We're going to make this work.
We're going to build a country.
Yeah.
And that spirit seems to have dwindled. Like now you get people who, it's not just young people, old people too, they just don't have any faith.
Mm-hmm. I think our people have been sadly disappointed because a lot of the promises that were made by our government necessarily have not been fulfilled. We see the job losses. And for me, context is everything. So if we think back to where we come from, as a country, now the challenges we faced post-apartheid are exactly the similar challenges that Europe faced post-World War II. So we needed to re-engineer a new economy, and then we went, of course, focused into minerals. We looked at agriculture as a country, and between 1994 and 1998, our economy grew by about, I think, 3.8%. And literally between that time, the black middle class doubled in its numbers. So we were a country on a particular trajectory. Then 1998, the crash happens. And then literally 2 million jobs get wiped out. So the cascading effect, of course, now is that those 2 million people who became unemployed, their children subsequently had no opportunity to go to school, had no opportunity to, you know, have a better life.
Yeah.
And so I think context is everything where we find ourselves now today. But then we have to say, okay, now we're here. Now we're here. It's 2019. We sit with 58% of our youth unemployed. We sit with 26% of the total population unemployed. What now?
Yeah.
So we need a decisive leadership that is going to really reignite that sense of hope. The way I see it in my head, I think we need an ecosystem where government, where funding institutions, where mentoring as an ecosystem works to be able to bring up young entrepreneurs, because I firmly believe that it's entrepreneurship that is going to change the lot of our country. With the fourth industrial revolution, the jobs are becoming obsolete. Entrepreneurship is something that needs to be taught at school level. There must be legislation for it. You can't teach somebody at uni first year and, you know, trying to make them an entrepreneur. I became an entrepreneur at the age of 6. So if we begin to think like that and look how we can have a creative destruction, you know, if something is not working, break it and then build a new mold to be able to move the society
forward. But you see, we're also still stuck on the old ways of doing things.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of that that has to change. Now, I want to go into some of the details of the book here, because you revealed a lot of things that must have been very difficult for you to decide to share with people. You know, you and your husband have done a really good job of just keeping a little bit of your life private. You know, there's some space for you and your children. There's some space for you to actually be normal human beings and to not be these media personalities, these public profiles that everybody expects you to be. And I congratulate you
on
that. And I think it's amazing.
Thank you.
And in this book, you've pulled the curtain back a little bit and let people in some pretty intimate areas. Now, you mentioned the miscarriages. And I mean, that's trying to start a family is a very personal, very intimate thing. And the fact that you two went through such hell to try and make that happen must have been extremely difficult.
It was just beyond painful to battle your fertility journey in public, wherein one day you're being written about that, you know, you're having a baby. The next day they say, well, she lost the baby. At 20 weeks, I lost twins in 2007.
And then, of course, that has an impact on how you feel about yourself.
Oh, yes.
As a woman.
Absolutely.
How you feel betrayed by your own body.
Yeah.
How you feel like maybe you can't, there's something wrong with you.
And you blame yourself to say, maybe I should have rested a little bit more. Maybe I shouldn't have traveled, you know, took on that assignment. And it also makes you doubt yourself. Because, you know, in our culture, it's such a funny thing. After 9 months, everybody says, so where is the baby? As if a baby is somebody that you pick up from a retail store. And you go to relatives' events.
Like it's an accessory.
Yeah, to say, well, when are you falling pregnant? You know, people feeling that they have the right.
Yeah. People ask these questions.
They ask you these questions, and you think, my goodness, how insensitive. I had to find it within me to, first of all, not lose hope and faith that I will be a mother of many. It's something that has always been in my consciousness and in my being. I knew that I was going to be a mother. I've always wanted to be a mother. And even when it didn't look possible, I refused to give up. I refused to quit. I refused to believe that it is not for me. And thank God, I've got three beautiful children today who are just remarkable, and they're good kids, you know. And Khumalo, I mean, I don't know what I would do without that incredible man who just said, if that's what you want, I did not marry you because you should produce for me. I married you because I just wanted to spend the rest of my life with you. If we have children, great. If we're not, that's also fine.
Why do you think there are so many people who, when you two have been lucky, you found each other, and you found each other at a really great age too, and you've lived this incredible and extraordinary life where you've both really experienced the best of the world, right?
Yeah, we have.
You have, and you've had career success, both of you, and you've had an admiration and a respect for each other, which I think a lot of people are envious of. And sometimes when people look at that from the outside, they're so jealous. You know, we have this problem in this country.
We sure do.
And nobody likes to talk about it, but they're so jealous, and they look at it and they go, there must be something wrong. And if there isn't, we're going to find something wrong.
We live in a very sad, toxic society.
You see it on social media.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the vitriol that gets spewed on social media is very disturbing. And I think oftentimes, when people try to find fault on others, I think it's a projection of the self, and therefore they would have to find fault in what perhaps, I mean, we don't have the perfect marriage. We are a married couple that have ups and downs, and we agree to disagree, but with much respect for one another. And so we, earlier on, when we dated and even got married, we're very clear that we're just going to live our lives. Devoid of whatever the perception of the people outside would think about us and our relationship. So we've never really allowed a lot of noise to take over our lives. And when you still your mind and you tell yourself, I will guard my space and my energy with what is good and positive. I mean, we read a lot of abominable stuff about us on social media, and we get shocked to say, wow, people do have creative minds. But then you realize that people are sad.
But you also had to put up with stalkers. You've had to put up with some pretty horrible. I mean, you also write very honestly about Dingaan Thobela,
mm-hmm.
and about that abusive relationship, mm-hmm. something I think a lot of women in this country can identify with.
Yeah.
There are so many silent victims who are going through situations where they just feel they can't escape.
Yeah.
And to hear that you've been through similar things, I think would empower a lot of people.
It was important to tell that story and that part of my life, that gender-based violence knows no social status, economic status, race. It looks like a Bastana Khumalo too, to give it a face, that Bastana Khumalo did survive an abusive relationship, so you too can. Because if you think of the stats, I mean, every 3 hours, a woman is murdered in South Africa. Just the rate of GBV in our country is high, 5 times the global average.
Yeah.
And so so it was important that I share that story exactly as it happened and how I found my courage to walk away with my life. Because many women stay and they lose their lives in those abusive relationships. So I wanted to give somebody a sense of hope that if Bastana could find it within herself to walk away, they too can, speak to the nearest police station, go to the church, speak to an elder in the community, find help to walk away. And Gareth, for me, the other issue is, when women are economically emancipated, we make better choices for our lives, for our bodies, for our children.
Well, and everybody, because when women are emancipated economically, they are able to improve everything around them.
Absolutely.
And communities grow out of that. And this is the single greatest effect in all of human history. The minute a population of women are able to choose for themselves whether they want to do this, whether they want to have a child, whether they want to live with this man or that one, or they want to be on their own, everything gets better.
It just gets better. A nation gets better. Humanity gets better. The world becomes a better place. And so for me, it is important to continue to encourage women, to go to school, seek employment, make your own choices.
And don't rely on a man.
Don't rely on the man. And can I, you just triggered something in my head. One of the things that really, really trouble me today as a 45-year-old mother is this advent of blessers. Blessers, okay? Where young people, all they're worried about is to getting a weave that goes to how many ever inches and going to a trip to Dubai and a Louis Vuitton bag. And what kind of culture and a society are we becoming when we think that is the norm?
But even on an individual level, to sell your soul for things that you can buy.
It's just not the country that we should be aspiring to be. We live in a society right now where it is so pervasive and so disturbing. Mm. And raising a daughter, for me, is very, very worrying. I want to be able to wake up to a country where I'm raising a president, a child who could be able to own her place in the sun and to work hard. Why is it that people just don't want to work anymore? Why is it that people just want to...
I think it's because you go on social media and you see how all these other people look like they've got these great lives. Now, I mean, you understand a lot of that is smoke and mirrors.
Of course.
You've been in the TV business. You know how much of what the world is isn't what really is going on behind the scenes. People's lives are hard.
Life
but
is
when
hard.
You go on Instagram and you see these celebrities and you suddenly think, well, I should have that. I don't need to work for it. It should just happen to me like it did for Kim Kardashian.
Yeah. But then we have to go back to who we are, Ubuntu Betu, as South Africans, and what drives us and what makes us unique. It cannot be that some old guy is going to give some 20-year-old gifts at what price?
but you also stand up for yourself. Like, I loved reading the book about how you took Jackie Pamuzza to court.
Yeah.
You stood up for yourself. You don't tolerate this stuff and lie down and let people walk all over you.
It's totally unacceptable when people can utter abominable things about you and your family, and then they think they can get away with it. Sitting on Twitter Mountain and being keyboard warriors and think that, you know, we only trade on our good names. That's all that we have.
I know there's something else that would irritate you, because it irritates me too, is these people who suddenly are doing a revisionist history of Nelson Mandela and saying, oh, he could have done more, he didn't do this, he wasn't that, he was a sellout. You know, you hear all this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you knew the man.
Oh, yeah. You know, when I hear that, I see red. You tell me if anybody at the Rivonia trial, and that I did not even know that he was going to be sentenced, and he stood there and made that famous speech to say, this is an ideal that I'm prepared to die for. Is anybody today prepared to die for anything? All they're doing is looting. All they're doing is literally bringing this country to disrepute. Here was a man who said, wearing his Xhosa regalia on that final day at the Rivonia trial, to say, this is an ideal that I am prepared to die for. Nobody's prepared to die for anything these days. They want freebies. They want flashy cars. They want big perks. They want big homes. Madiba taught us even how leaders in the continent should conduct themselves. Only serve one term.
Exactly.
He was not hungry for power. He was just wanting to make this world a better place. And therefore, when I hear this revisionist history, I'm like, wow, wow, really? Go back and do your history.
You still have a very good relationship with Grasa Michelle, right? You see Mum Grasa all the time.
Yeah. She's just extraordinary. You know, I've got a chapter in the book about standing on the shoulders of giants. And I've been mentored by such phenomenal men and women throughout my life. And
really
she's
have.
One such. But
you've passed it on too. This is something I've got to congratulate you for.
Thank you.
Like, you passed this on. There are so many people I've met in the media world, which is obviously a world that you've inhabited for a long time too, and they say that Basitsana Khumalo is their inspiration, and she's taken them in and she's mentored them and she's helped them and she's given them work, and this is what you do.
I'm intentional about that. I'm intentional about how I live my life and very conscious about the responsibility that I have to use this medium, to use this platform that I've been blessed with over the last 25 years to impact lives, to bring young people along. And for me, paying it forward is such a fundamental part of my life purpose. They say that with great power comes great responsibility, and to whom much is given, much is indeed expected. And so I live by those, you know, ethos and the truth that if I can be able to see a young doctor, Dr. Tsidi Kule, who I mentored for the last 15 years, and become a medical entrepreneur and see her growth, then it is well with my soul. Then I'm living my true purpose.
Well, this book is great. I encourage anyone who hasn't got it already to get it, because it's number one for a reason.
Thank you.
And you are a tremendous author, among all the other great things that you've done. Now we can also say that you're a great author.
Thank you.
And lots of love to the family.
Thank you, Gareth.
It's terrific to spend time with you. The best, Basi, My Journey of Hope, is the book. Go and get it ASAP. And you can indulge in her story and maybe live a little vicariously through her in parts of it. In other parts of it, you wouldn't want to be her. But that's the story of all of us. There are parts that we are delighted to reread, and there are parts that are really, really painful to reread. Mm-hmm. But you've done a beautiful job of it. Thank you.
Thank you so, so much for having me, Gareth. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is CliffCentral.com.